Hello and welcome to the Aesthetic Insider Show. I'm so excited about today's guest, Dr. Steve Dayan. We all know Dr. Dayan for many of the hats that he wears here in the aesthetic industry, but his practice is, he is a facial plastic surgeon. He's based in Chicago. But one of the things that I feel about Dr. Steve Dayan is he is the ultimate aesthetic renaissance man. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Stephen, Dr. Dayan, thank you so much for being on the Aesthetic Insider Show. It's such a pleasure to have you here today.
Oh, thanks so much, Angela. It's a pleasure to be here. I get a lot of requests, but you know, I for sure was excited to have your request and I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I figured, you know, you spend a lot of your kind of extracurricular time outside of the practice doing interviews with many people around the world. And I thought, you know, it's time for me to interview him and really let our audience know about the wonderful kind of life and career that you have created. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Oh my gosh, that's a long story, but I'm a facial plastic surgeon from Chicago, and that's a big part of what I do every day, and that's my focus. But I'm someone who's got a lot of curiosity, so I'm always looking for something new and exciting. So I'm insanely curious, you know, and I think that's what drives me to do many other things. So over the years, I've built a research company. I've built a marketing company, a medical education company, and I've sold them off. And now I'm working on a program I do with Sabrina Fabry, who's my fiance. We call it Thriving, and we're having a lot of fun doing that around the world. We're educating around the world with that. That's been a lot of fun. I sold my practice to private equity a year ago, and now I'm the medical director of that group, and it's called MedSpa Partners. So I'm still very active with that because I'm medical director for the U.S., but that's been a really exciting new venture as well. So I'm always looking for new adventures.
You know, and I love that curious. I mean, because I do think curiosity is, from what I hear anyway, is something that keeps us young, young at heart, young in mind, and young in body as well. And so with that in mind, what was Stephen like as a child? Were you the curious child?
That's a good question. I think I've always been curious. I think that's something that's quite innate. I've always been someone who wants to learn or explore. As also means I'm an explorer. And I believe that all of us have one of four archetypes: explorers, domesticators, facilitators, or warriors. And I think we each are one of those four. We have a major and a minor. And when we're inebriated, or when we're older, we're young, our archetype comes out. So explorers, warriors, domesticators, and facilitators, we have that. And if I asked you right now, like, which one is your mom or your dad or your best friend, you would tell me in a heartbeat if they're an explorer, a warrior, or a facilitator, or a domesticator. So an explorer, someone who's always like wanting to like look around the corner, that they want to test out the new restaurant. They're the ones who want to go on new vacations. They're not happy doing the same thing all the time. They're always looking for something new. The warrior is the person who wants to square off, no matter what it is. Yeah. So it's your guy friend who may want to get into a bar fight. It's your girlfriend who every time she has a few drinks, she's argumentative with you or whatever. It's someone who's like that. Facilitators or domesticators are people who like to stay at home. So there's someone like on a Saturday night with a glass of wine, they are so happy. You're like, come on, did you want to go out? And they're like, no, I really want to stay home. I'm happy at home. They're domesticators. And then facilitators are the go-betweens. They're the party planners. And they're the people that bring friends together. So I think each one of us has one of those archetypes. And I'm an explorer. And I just, you know, once you come to grips with what you are, it always makes it easier. Yeah. But I will tell you, as a kid, I was a horrible student. So I was getting, C's in high school. And I was doing terrible in high school. And I played football, and I was more interested in playing football and being socially active than I was in academics. I wasn't a very good student. My dad's an immigrant, barely speaks English. My mom got sick with MS, so she was really incapacitated a lot of when I was a child. So I did a lot of raising on my own of myself, and I didn't have the heart to tell my dad that I wasn't getting good grades. And when it came time to apply for college, my grades were not so good, and I couldn't get into my state school, which is University of Illinois.
Well,
and I got rejected, and I was like, what am I going to do now? I got rejected from the state school. I couldn't even get into my state college, and I didn't have money. We were broke. So I was like, where am I going to go to college? So then I had an uncle who was very wealthy, and he said, okay, well, I'll pay for some of your college. If you can get some of it, I'll pay for some of it too. So I got student loans. but he said, you have to live at home with your grandmother and take care of her. This is my 80-year-old Moroccan grandmother, doesn't speak any English. I was going to live with her and take care of her. And that was the deal. Then Washington University in St. Louis called and said, you want to play football? I'm like, yeah, where are you? I had never heard of Washington University. They were in St. Louis, and I played football. So they got me in on a football scholarship. And I went there, and they gave me a bunch of money, and I went to WashU. And I showed up at WashU and said, I want to be a doctor. And they go, are you kidding us? You didn't take any honors classes. You don't have one A in all of high school. I'm like, I was too naive. Sometimes naivety is bliss. So I got to WashU and be a doctor. So I started studying really hard. I quit football because I couldn't do both football and study because I wasn't a good student. But I studied and studied, and I just became incredibly motivated to become a doctor one day. And that was my dream. And I studied, and all of a sudden I started getting the A's, and I got all A's through college. I never would have thought I would have gotten that. And the funny thing is I went to all my interviews for med school. I got into every med school I applied to except for one. The one I didn't get into was Harvard. But I go to my Harvard interview, and sitting in my Harvard interview is a valedictorian of my high school class, Richie Miller. I'm like, Rich, what are you doing here? He's like, Steve, what are you doing here? I'm like, you're not going to believe this. I'm smart. He's like, oh my gosh, you were like this athlete. You were a jock. You weren't really much of a student. I go, no, I did really good. Anyways, I got waitlisted at Harvard. I didn't get in. So then I went to University of Illinois for med school because it was free. And I got a ride there. So I went to University of Illinois and I did really well there and graduated top of my class there. So, and then that was my route. So as a student, as a kid, I was an explorer. I was an athlete, but I really was not a student as a kid. I was more of an athlete and more of a social being.
Well, you know, I love that because that really was a mindset, wasn't it? That you realizing what you wanted as a dream, but able to turn your life around in a way so that you could get the grades necessary to bring you where you are today. That takes a lot of willpower and a lot of just grit, you know?
So you bring up a really good point, and I think that's a super important point that needs to be emphasized over and over and over again, is the value to grit, the value to hard work, the value to not getting what you want. I think we've lost some of that. So I have a lot of sayings in my office, but when the staff comes to me and says, okay, Dr. Nam, what's the budget? I'm like, budget zero, get as close to it as you can. Because if the budget is zero, that's when you get creative. And everything I've ever done came because I was super lucky to be broke.
Yes.
The best thing I ever had in my life is I had no money. When you have no money, you get creative because you have to figure out ways. So every company I've created, every business venture I've done has all come out of being creative. And every time there's a budget and someone gives me money to do something is when it's not as good. It's better when I have to figure it out on my own because that's when you find the angle that no one ever thought of before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Enormous value there in that grit. And unfortunately, I think it's lost too often and too many young people today.
Well, I would agree with you because, I mean, we do, the world's changed a bit, but, and I'm the youngest of six, Irish Catholic from, you know, Manchester, England, and came to America with $200, which I'd saved. And I created my life here in America, you know, I bought 43 years ago. And it was definitely through hard work, imagination, and all of the things that you talk about. And, you know, there were times that I remember, you know, well, I don't get paid for another week and I only got this much money and this much groceries and this much. And, you know, I can't even afford to take the bus to work, so I will walk. that's kind of what I have to do. And I think, you know, for me, I always looked at it as growing up with parents that were Irish immigrants to Manchester, parents who had lived through World War II, you know, and told stories and romanticized their hardships during World War II. They were teenagers, you know, but it was kind of like, looking back now, it's like, that must have been some pretty terrifying times. But, you know, the parents that we had, like you said, your father, you know, was an immigrant here to America. He, you know, didn't speak English or barely spoke English. And that would present challenges for him and for you, I would imagine, growing up. So good for you. Good for you. That's amazing. What a great story.
So a lot of people always say to you is, does love or money buy happiness? And the flippant answer is no, money and love doesn't buy happiness. So one day I'm sitting in first class, this is recently, and I was like, wow, I'm really happy. I'm really happy I'm in first class. I like this. I feel good about it. And then I was like feeling guilty. I'm like, money's kind of buying me some happiness. It's buying me happiness because I'm in first class. But then I started thinking about this a little bit deeper. And I do believe that love or money can buy you happiness if and only if you have to work for it. So you appreciate it so much more. So if you work hard for something, whether it's building your practice or building a career for yourself, or love too, if you work hard at love, I believe you appreciate both those so much more, and it will bring you happiness. If it's given to you, if you win the lottery, or you come from a wealthy family and you just have that fancy car, or you have that house, or you have those nice clothes, you don't appreciate it, or it doesn't give you happiness as much as if you have to work for it.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. And I think it also motivates you to that next level, because I think some of it is like, oh, look at me. Look how far I came. You know, you have to pat yourself on the back to, you know, you reached that goal, you got to that level, you created, you know, whatever, or you bought yourself whatever you bought. But what's next? You know, and so I think it's definitely is great motivation. So let me ask you a question, because, you know, when you kind of look at from a business perspective, and I don't just mean in aesthetics, but just across the board, there are those people who tend to, you know, they climb the hill and then they fall back down. They climb the hill and they fall back down, and or they begin to get lazy, for want of a better phrase, or they become they think they forgot how hard they worked to get where they did. Have you ever run across people like that? What is your take on that?
I think what I see more of are people who don't have that work ethic from the beginning because they never had to. Most of the people I know who've got that grit or that hard work ethic continue forever. And if they fail, it's because they keep trying something that no one else has ever done before. Yeah. But that failure is only this an opportunity for the next step. And I'm really good at failing, really good at it. In fact, I failed at so many things, and I sold 7 companies, but I've started 14. You know, so no one asks you about the failures, but I've had so many things implode. But that every time that happens to me, I get better. So what people, oftentimes I was interviewing someone who wanted to work for me. This is recently, it was a graduating resident. And it's like, well, I only want to work 3.5 days a week, and I want 6 weeks vacation, and I want research time, and I want new lasers, and by the way, I want to be famous. I'm like, you want to be famous? He's like, yeah, I want to be famous. I'm like, wait, you want to be famous? What does that mean? He's like, well, I want to be like you and travel around the world and give lots of lectures. I'm like, okay, but it doesn't come working 3.5 days a week. You have to like work on the weekends. You have to work extra. You got to come up with creative insight. You don't just become famous. You don't just become no. And if that's your goal, I don't think it's gonna happen. You have to work hard at something and create something that's unique and different and creative insight. So when I first went into practice, I liked research. It wasn't like I was the biggest research guy in the world doing a lot of bench research in the laboratory and doing beakers, but I wanted to get patients in the door. And at that time, laser hair removal was so popular; it was the hottest product in all of. In medicine, it was the early 2000s, and I wanted a laser hair removal, but I couldn't afford the laser. So a rep comes to my office and shows me a laser hair removal device. I'm like, wow, that's really cool. I'd really like to get that laser, but it's $100,000, and I had no money. I was living off the bank on my loans. So at that time, a new laser came out, and you might remember this laser, Angela. It was called the Nlyte, and it was this big laser. It was the size of a room, but it got FDA approved to do non-ablative wrinkle reduction. So FDA approved. I was like, wow. And that was the biggest rage. It was so hot back then. And I brought the laser in. It took up the size of an office, you know, to test it one day. And it barely did anything, but it was the biggest rage. It was on Oprah and everyone was on the talk shows. Everybody wanted it. So I couldn't afford that. But this laser hair removal device I also wanted, couldn't afford that either. But I figured out that this laser hair removal device, which was a 1064 laser, I believed it could also do a non-ablative wrinkle reduction, because the mechanism was the same. So I studied it. I wrote a protocol. I wrote this whole study, took it to an IRB, got it approved. And then I called the company. And I called the sales rep. I go, hey, that laser that you brought in that does laser hair removal, that's kind of small, I think would fit in my trunk of my car because I wanted to move it between offices. I'm like, I think it can do non-ablative laser removal. He's like, why do you say that? I'm like, well, this is the mechanism of action. I believe it works. He's like, you need to speak to my research director. So ASDS is in Chicago that month. Takes me down to the Hyatt where the ASDS is. I meet the research director and the CEO of this company is there. It's called LaserScope. Company's long gone. Yeah. And I'm sitting there, my second year of practice. And I say, here's an IRB approved protocol that your laser, which you're selling for hair removal, also can remove wrinkles. They said, what? I go, yeah, I think your laser can also remove wrinkles. And if it gets FDA approved for that, you can then market it for millions and millions of dollars if it can also remove lasers. I go, I think I can get it FDA approved. Have you ever done this before? No. Who are you? I'm like, well, you don't know who I am, but one day you will. So they said, okay, what is the cost? I go, nothing. I just want the use of the laser. They go, you just want the use of the laser. You don't have to pay me. I just want to be able to use the laser during the course of the study. This is early 2000s. So I did the study myself with my front desk person, and we got it FDA approved. I helped get it FDA approved for like wrinkle removal. What, was I a researcher? No, but I created the study. Could it have not worked? Could it have not get approved? It was all risk, but I did all the work up front. If you say to someone, you have to do all this work up front and it may fail, it may not work. Most people are like, well, I'm not going to do that. I want to make sure I get paid for that. But all that work got me to understand lasers, which then led me to me lecturing because someone invited me to give a speech. Like, will you come out to California and talk about your findings? I'm like, I can't afford to fly to California. Like, no, we're going to pay you to go to California. I'm like, wait, you're going to pay for my flight? You're going to pay for my flight and my hotel room to go to California? I'm like, where do I sign up for this? So they flew me out to California. They get me a hotel room. I present for the first time. I never spoke before in front of a crowd. And I spoke it. I guess went pretty well. I did 13 more after that. One thing leads to another, but it all starts with some creative insight that you have that you can take it to the next level. And that is something that is lost often in young people who are doing startups right now. No one just hands you being famous. No one just hands you these creative ideas. You got to come up with it, and it comes with hard work.
Yeah. I think as well, like, there was a need there. You know, you had various needs. So you had the need that you wanted the laser in your practice. You had the need to have it do something it didn't do. and then the desire to actually try and make it do something that it wasn't pegged to do. But that's great. But what was the process of that? How long did that take?
Well, I wrote the protocol. It probably took me a week or two to write it. Then I had to get in front of an IRB that usually every month they would meet. So I got it approved by the IRB. I fronted all that. And then I had to take it to the company to see if they liked it. So the whole process, it took a few months. I don't remember exactly because it was 25 years ago. But it was the origin of me doing research. And then one thing led to another. So nothing good happens fast.
Yes. Well, what's the old saying? It takes 25 years to become an overnight success.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. So then moving on from that being your first research project, and then you said you had a company that you sold that was a research company.
I sold half of it to a partners who now are my partners. So I have 30 or no, now it's 11 dermatologists. It's a large dermatology group in Chicago, and they bought half of it. So they're my partners.
That's great.
We do derm anesthetics research. Yeah.
Okay. So moving on from research again, because you're the Renaissance man, and there's so many areas of things that you have done and created that we haven't touched on yet. Moving on from research, what was next?
Well, marketing. And so back in the day, this is before there was social media. When I first went into practice, I decided I want to get a website. This is kind of funny because a website back then was like a big deal.
Yeah.
And remember, I was on staff at the university, and I was part-time at the university, and my colleagues at the university were like, we don't think it's a good idea for you to have a website. We think that's a little too out there. As a plastic surgeon, you should be in the yellow pages at most. And I was like, okay. So I had to like secretly get a website, and that was considered rogue at that time. Consider that by today's standards, how benign that is. So I put a website together. I created it myself because it was just getting started. And once again, I was broke. I had the luxury of being broke. And I figured out how to create a website, But then like I wanted to get an advertisement. So I had a $3,000 advertising budget my first year in practice. I took half the money $750 or so, and bought some ads at a local women's newspaper. I put the ad in there, and it was this, you know, come see me ad I created because I had to create it myself. And paper came out on Thursday. I was so excited. I opened up, I look at the paper, and there's my ad. I was so proud of it. I didn't get any phone calls. And I was like, oh, that's disappointing. So then I took a before and after picture, bought half a page, spent the rest of my marketing budget for the most part in that magazine. Week later comes out. I was so impressed. no phone calls. So I spent all my money on my marketing budget on a couple of ads, didn't really do much. And I realized something. I was the youngest guy in the paper. I had no experience. Why is anyone going to come to me? Nobody was going to come to me for that. So I realized that wasn't going to work. I had to get creative. I called it guerrilla marketing. How do you get busy with no cost? So I started coming up with creative ways to get busy with no cost. So Botox was this curious drug that was just coming out at that time. And most plastic surgeons were like, it's beneath us. They're not going to touch it. Even dermatologists really weren't doing it because it wasn't cost effective because you had to open up the vial. We were told you had to use it in 4 hours. So unless you had more than one patient, it wasn't profitable for you to do it. But to me at that time, I'm like, well, this will be a marketing expense because if I get a person in the door, I'll do Botox on them. The satisfaction rate is 95 to 97%. People were super excited about it. They were happy about it. So I started making Botox my marketing budget. So I bought a vial. I would treat a patient. I covered my cost. And if they were happy, they'd come back for something else. That was my plan back then. So I started doing that. And that was really good to get my practice busy. So I started becoming a Dr. Botox. They started calling me in Chicago because one of the few doctors who was really doing it. And I started writing about it, putting articles in the newspaper. I would start pitching it to the local TV stations. And so I got a gig on local news. I was on ABC News 7 right away doing their segments for aesthetics every month. Every month I did it once a month, do a live segment on there. And I would pitch them constantly each month with new stories. So I started becoming a regular on the TV stations. I started writing articles for anyone and anyone who would take it. I wasn't a writer. In fact, I failed high school English. But I'm like, someone's got to write about myself and no one else can write about me. So I started writing about myself. And then I started writing newsletters and putting newsletters out into the community. So I got creative at how to make all these things work. So newsletters started working, started bringing people in the door. My articles and papers led to me creating a magazine. And I actually built a magazine with a partner. So one of the local newspapers, me and him created a magazine called Chicago Health. We started running articles every month. I got companies to sponsor it. I would throw a big party, invite people to come, and then I'd get companies to sponsor it. And then I would do a little lecture about Botox or fillers or surgery. And that, so one thing led to another, but all these had one thing in common. They cost pretty much zero to do. So they started doing pretty well. And then and then Medisys in like 2006 or seven at the time was launched, or it was early on, was like, would you give a lecture in New York about how you got busy because my non-surgical business was exploding. I said, okay. So they flew me out to New York. I go up there and I give a lecture. I'm in a room and it's like a Thursday night in some beautiful restaurant and big deal. And back then a lot of people would show up, 150 people were there or so from New York. And I come out and they're like, we're introducing Dr. Stephen Ann. He's going to talk to you about how I got busy in Chicago. And it's a New York crowd. They're like, who the hell is he? What does he know? And this woman in the front, Rena Prieto, who I'm actually good friends with now, is like, what can you tell us? You're from Chicago. And I'm like, okay, I'll tell you what. If I can give you three tips that you can use in your practice tomorrow, you got to get me a bottle of wine. And if I can't give you one tip, I'll give you a bottle of wine. And that's how I started the lecture. And it went from there. And it went really well. And people liked it. I gave them all these tips, the things that I was doing. I came up with these formulas and these ideas, which I can talk about ad nauseum. And I ended up writing about a book called Thrive. And that book sold like crazy. It became a big seller. And I had a bunch of people buying it in bulk all around the world. And that then I started getting phone calls. People were like, well, can we get more of your ideas? I would just give them my ideas. But then I hired someone to help me because it was getting too busy. And then before you know it, I had 40 employees in a marketing company and 4,000 accounts who were getting busy. And then I kept that going until 2014 and Valiant bought the whole thing. Everyone remembers Valiant, but they imploded. They were trying to get Allergan and they thought they were going to get Allergan. So they bought my marketing company as their marketing arm. But they never got Allergan. So, and then eventually the Valiant screwed that up, like a lot of things.
How that happened?
That was my marketing experience. Yeah. So I have a ton of experience. It's the fundamentals of marketing and they don't change. And it's interesting. We use social media today, which didn't exist when I was doing all this, but the fundamentals are the same. How to keep people interested. What's appealing to their core. So I call it safe sex, appetite, fear, and ego. Appeal to their primal instincts and people will pay attention.
You know what I find, for me, what I find interesting about what you just said is because, you know, I've been in PR and marketing forever, and I know how much hard work it is to be pitching those stations, to be writing those articles, to be doing all of that. And the fact that you were able to to actually make the time to do that shows me the kind of drive that you have just in your life in general, which is
Angela, was that a necessity? Because I had to feed my two babies, you know. I was coming, I was in the hole, a lot of money. So it was all out of necessity.
Yeah. Which goes back to kind of what we were saying. It's like, you know, the value of hard work, the appreciation of what you've achieved, and respect for yourself in what you're doing. Well, what a great story. You've got many great stories and so many pills of advice, I think, here, even to offer to other new physicians. How do you feel about social media? And what's your take on, not just that it's here, it exists, and it's going to change, but how our industry is represented or being represented, or physicians are representing themselves? Do you have any insight into good things to do, not so good things to do? What's your thoughts there?
I have a ton of thoughts on this, and I've thought it through quite often and quite deeply. Never in the history of humanity has one person be able to reach so many people so quickly, so easily, for so little. You can be in your garage and you become famous tomorrow. That has never existed throughout all of history. So it's really quite amazing that you can become famous tomorrow with no cost if you really put out incredibly creative content. So you'll see a lot of young doctors now who become famous right away. They may not even be good, but people will come to see them just because they're so creative online. So there becomes an incentive to get crazier and do more of, you know, things that are on the cutting edge. And so I struggle with that a little bit because, of course, I want good content to be out there. I want things that are safe. I think as a physician, you have responsibility to do things that are safe. However, I don't believe that anyone is necessarily the arbitrator of what everyone else should be doing. I think we have a responsibility as a physician to be ethical to our boards and to ourselves and to our patients. But when some people come in and say, you can't do this or you can't do that, it gets me a little bit concerned, because I was given a hard time because I was doing website marketing back then, and I was going into med spas, and that was considered very rogue at the time. So I was on the other end of being a rogue doctor in the early 2000s. So I feel a little bit for some of the doctors who are doing out there, who are pushing content, who are creative. I love what they're doing. But if they're offering information that hurts people, I think that is a line. I'm just not the one who's going to decide what that line is. But I think they have to be careful. I think social media is important. I don't think you can come out today and build a business, any business, whether it's medical or anything, without social media as part of your strategy. I have a ambivalent and somewhat complicated relationship with social media. I hate it and love it at the same time. I think it's a necessary evil, but I think it sucks the energy and it sucks your moments and it steals your soul. Because you could be doing something that's so wonderful, and if you have to document it, you just stole that moment. And I don't like that. But you can also have an opportunity to be like, share a moment with friends and family. That could be just a wonderful and beautiful moment too, that you couldn't do in the past. So I think it's this complicated issue that we have to treat it in moderation, like any dopamine seducing event, whether it's a drug or anything else. You have to be able to control your appetite for it. And that includes social media. Also, it can become destructive and dangerous. I think we've all seen too much of that with children. And I think we all always have kids know that we have to pull these phones away or else it becomes a problem. I think that a lot of people, a lot of companies come out and they'll tell you what you have to do with social media. You need to post 14 times a day and it needs to be, and I don't believe in any of that. I say bullshit. I say you make social media what it fits for you, because what makes social media great is the authenticity of it. If you want to be good on social media, if you want to have a following, then be authentic. Don't be anyone but yourself. If you try to be someone else, it fails miserably. So if you want to post once a month, post once a month. If you want to post 10 times a day, post 10 times a day. But it's got to be you and your story. And everyone's like, well, it can't be too long, it can't be too short. No, there's people who will watch an hour-long podcast if the content is great. And there's people who you can't even keep their mind for like 2 seconds if it's not good. If the content is great, people will pay attention. So make the content you, and if they like you, they'll pay attention. So I put content out there that's me. I'll write something that I find interesting. And a lot of people are like, you know what? What he writes is just, I can't read it. It's too long. It's not for them. Okay, well, they move on to someone who's going to show, you know, some fantastic video or some gory video, and that's what they like. But that's not the person who appeals to me. The people who like what I do are the people who want to think a little bit different, want to bend their mind. So I developed an audience of that. That audience is not going to be as big as someone who's looking to have, you know, bigger breasts or wider hips or wider butt. But that's not what I'm selling. I'm selling thinking differently. So you have to do what's authentic to you. I guess it's a long answer to your question, but.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, because again, having that background in PR and marketing is my concern has always been, and we actually touched on it a little bit even before we started the recording today, was on reputation. And so, you know, I kind of scroll through and I see, and sometimes I'm like, ooh, you know, I do want to see that. That was too much information. And or, you know, is it the wrong message that's being, because it kind of makes cosmetic surgery look so easy. And
yes,
it's serious, it's surgery. And so I think that's my ambivalence. I mean, I love social media. I think it's great. It's easy to get hooked into it. But it's more on just, are you sure as a physician that, you know, this is something that you can't take back? It's out there. And is it good for your reputation? Or could it potentially damage your reputation?
Yes. Yeah. It could destroy you overnight, especially if you're out there promoting something that's dangerous or bad. If you're doing, you know, live surgery is a double-edged sword. If you want to show people live surgery, something goes wrong, that's legal tape that's going to be used against you. The patient may come against you. So I'm definitely more conservative than a lot of people, but I built my brand. I don't need to do that to build my practice. Would I think differently if I was just coming out now? Perhaps. But looking at it as an older, more conservative doctor by standards I've set today, I would say you got to be super careful, because your reputation, as everyone, I mean, it's truth. You can destroy it overnight. It takes years to build, but it can destroy it, yeah.
Yeah, and I think what you just mentioned earlier about how, you know, you can become famous from your garage now. And so there are, you know, doctors who have rapidly become famous, but how experienced are they? You know, and that's my, again, and maybe I've been around too long, I don't know, but. You know, I have a client who has been a client for over 30 years who now his nephew is coming in, moving in, taking over the practice. It's like, we've really got to get him out there. We've got to build his reputation. You know, we've got to do this. And like, we've got to have a big social media campaign for him. And to me, he's like, but he hasn't done anything yet. You know, we don't really have much to go on from my perspective until, you know, he starts gathering his own before and after pictures and his own patient results and his own style and method of how he's going to execute himself, you know, within this world, not just, you know, using everything that you've created over the last 30 years. So I do ask, because I kind of, like you, I love and hate it.
Yeah. You know, yeah, my young partner is 6 years out now. He was doing live surgery, talking during it. He's getting 100,000 people watching him, 100,000 people live. Those are CNN numbers. I was blown away. He's seeing 20 to 30 consults a week. I mean, it was overwhelming, and people flying in from all around the world. He was my resident not too long ago, you know, and he's definitely, you know, far surpassing me in social media on TikTok. And I don't really do much TikTok. But, you know, I get a call from one of the doctors in the community saying, Steve, you see what your partner's doing? I'm like, yeah. They're like, you better put a stop to that. So I could tell he was like rubbing people the wrong way in town. But then there was a woman, and I don't know if you remember this story. She was in Ohio, I think, plastic surgeon who was doing live surgery, and she lost her license. Something's went wrong or something like that. I think she was live on tape. She got sued. So I'm like telling my Ben, I'm like, I don't think live surgery is a good idea. So I convinced him not to do it. So he's not doing it anymore, live surgery. But the numbers are, you know, are astronomical. It's hard not to get drunken with that success. So it takes some, you know, discipline to not go out there and do what is going to get you sensationalized what you're doing. And that goes with what you say and what you do. But I do think you got to be careful, to your point.
And I think it's just, it's like the, what are the pros and cons and the consequences of this action. But it's, you know, it's easy to get caught up in it. And I mean, I'm watching it every day with just, you know, lives that I know the people behind these lives are not necessarily living that life. But by all appearances, it looks amazing, you know, and practices that are struggling but give the appearance of just having this amazing, amazingly successful place, you know. Anyway, that's just kind of my opinion. I just wondered what yours was.
I'm with you. But nothing. This hasn't changed. You know, there was the bars that were empty, but had a line out front.
Yeah.
For So people drop by and say, oh, I should go there. So this concepts are the same. But with medicine, we have fiduciary responsibility to always do the right thing. And I think we cannot get too far from that. Yeah.
Okay. So moving forward now. So we've been through the research, the marketing, and then I remember the Thrive book very well. What came next?
So I wrote a New York Times bestseller. And that was in 2000. I started writing in 2013, 14. So I started teaching a college undergraduate course at DePaul University on the science of beauty, its impact on culture and business in America. Because I became convinced that plastic surgery wasn't about making people look better. It was about making them feel better. Mm-hmm. And I got this idea because I would do a surgery and the nose would look great. I'm like, oh my gosh, your nose looks great. Here's like, I'm not happy. You're not happy. Your nose looks perfect. Doctor, I'm not happy. I'm like, how can you not be happy? I could not get a better result. I could publish this. I'm not happy. And then I have someone else and they still like have a little residual bumps from it. And they're like thrilled. Oh my gosh, you're the best doctor in the world. I'm so happy. So I realized that it wasn't about getting them the perfect physical outcome. It was about how I made them feel about themselves. And then I started doing a lot of research with Botox at the time. And I was studying like this concept of emotions. So we did studies 2008, 9, and 10 showing that I can improve the first impression someone makes with Botox. I can improve their quality of life and their self-esteem. I'm like, there's something else going on here. We're affecting emotions and expressions. And this is a lot deeper than just making a nose more perfect or a cheek more perfect or a face more perfect. And I dove so deep into this and studied evolutionary biology and neuropsychiatry and aesthetics. I took those three genres. I put together a lot of lectures on it. And then I pitched it to DePaul University, which is a local university here, and started teaching it. So then I took that plus my marketing experience and said, how can you use these concepts to get busier? And I showed how to do that. So it became a course. And it was an undergraduate course. I started teaching it, night school there. And I loved it. I love teaching because teaching is a passion for me. Teaching is not something you do to make money. You don't make money teaching. You do it because you love it. I love teaching. So I teach undergrads. And that was great. And then at the end, my students would ask for the syllabus. So I started taking the syllabus and putting it together in a book. And then someone said to me, why don't you make that into a book for the consumers? That's really interesting information. And I'm like, you think? So I spent the next year or so traveling, and I would go to these places and I would study beauty in every culture I could find. So I was in Iceland, Thailand, I was in Africa, and I would write and I'd find some hidden cove and just write and write and research and write. I would take a week and just write. And I loved it. And I got so into it. The more I got into it, the more I started to see things that I didn't see before. I was like learning a new language. And I started seeing beauty as something that was more evolutionarily predisposed and that attractiveness and beauty were different concepts, and that I was in a job making people more attractive, which was including self-confidence. And self-confidence is what I was after. It wasn't after beauty. So I published some papers on this. I published quite a few papers in the early 2010s on the science of beauty. Most of them got rejected at first. I actually have in my office here on the wall the rejections. We are not psychiatrists. We don't care about how people feel. We are about making people more beautiful. And I'm like, no. And now I look back, I laugh because patient-reported outcomes are part of every study. Yeah. You know, self-esteem and quality of life is now mandated when we do trials. But at that time, it was considered very rogue. So it wasn't, many people didn't want to listen to me because I was telling surgeons, put your scalpels down and start thinking about having a conversation with your patient about what's going to make them happier. So it wasn't a very popular notion at that time. So I'm like, I have to write this in a book because I'm convinced that this is important. And this message is not getting out. And my papers weren't enough. I wanted the consumers to get this message. So I wrote a book. And after 13 rejections, I finally got a publisher who took it. So 13 times it got rejected. And that was pretty heartening. 14th person said, okay, they took it on. And it hit number 9 on the New York Times bestsellers list. It didn't last long. And, I had a good marketing team. But that was exciting. That opened up a ton of doors for me. But more made me think differently. And so then I became a writer, and then I fell in love with writing. I used to be a sculptor with clay, and now my artistic outlet became writing. So that is now where I really enjoy doing my free time.
You know what I particularly enjoy is, I love that you wrote this book, and I do personally feel, you know, that we are changing lives. For the most part, you know, it isn't just about changing a nose. It really is changing somebody's life. And you know, I've written the kind of stories myself, not, you know, our patients who, you know, the girl who said, you know, I grew up and I always had a nose that I looked like my dad, and I didn't want to look like my dad. I wanted to look like me. And now having my nose, I feel I look like me. Yeah, maybe I still resemble my dad, but I look like me and I feel so much better, so much more confident in my life. And, you know, I think it's so important. What is the title of that book?
Subliminally Exposed.
Liminally Exposed, yeah, yeah. It's such a great concept. But what I was going to say, what I particularly like about what I see of you, and back to social media, is, you know, you really do a lot of creative writing on your social media posts that combine travel or your lifestyle of things. And I, myself, because I have a background in writing, and I love creative writers, and I just, certain authors, I love the way they execute, and the command they have of the English language is just phenomenal. And what I love is in your posts is you give such great descriptions into these areas where you go. And I do take the time to read because I'm a reader. So when you say, you know, even as a kid that you were not academic, you were, you know, in high school, you were failing all these grades, but now at this point in your life to kind of have such penmanship is amazing.
It happened overnight. Not overnight, but there was a moment, a watershed moment. What happened was I was writing a lot because I had to write to market myself and who I am, and articles for newspapers or articles for magazines or whatever I was doing for myself or for my patients. But I hated writing because the way we learned when I was a kid was write a thesis and then supporting arguments for your thesis and conclusion. I was not, that didn't resonate with me. I was artistic, I guess, in nature. So I sculpted a lot with clay. And that's what I was, my, all through med school residency, that's what I would do when I wanted free time to go work with clay. So I enjoyed that. Then one day I started looking at words like clay. I threw them on a piece of paper and then started sculpting them afterwards. I'm like, oh my gosh, words are like clay. And when I started to see words as clay, everything changed for me. So I just now throw the clay up throw the words of clay like on the paper and just start sculpting it and moving things around. And it became a totally different profession for me.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. Okay, so moving on, what was next?
I want to bring on one more thing. You talk about social media and writing about these different places. And there's a method to that, or a thought process behind that, because I never wanted to be like, look at me, I'm in Bali. Look at me, I'm in Indonesia. Look at me, I'm in Australia. It looks kind of just like, what am I trying to prove? I'm not doing that. So if I go somewhere, whether it's New Zealand or South Korea, I want to tell you a little bit about that space, something I found in there, like India is this country of layers. You know, I always try to find something unique about that place that's different. And then I'm like, oh, I never really thought about that, but I teased it out. And then I try to have the people follow me like, look, you might want to consider this part of Italy because it's built up like this and it's really interesting and unique. And you can see the different culture and different history and what it meant to the people there and how it affects their personalities. So I try to find that little insight and then relate that to the readers. So it's not just me in Matera, Italy, but it's me in a place that has 3,000 years of history in it. And this is why I find it so fascinating. Yeah. And hopefully you will too.
Well, I think that goes back to the curiosity as well. You know, the curious child in you that, you know, because I know for me, I've been on, you know, many trips with people, and I begin to question if we actually were on the same trip together. Because I'll have my, like, oh, remember this and that, and this I read about the history of this and that, and they are like, oh, you know, I never saw that, or we never went to that place, or we missed that. And it's like, were we not on the same, didn't we go on the same trip together?
Right.
We have two completely different stories of what we bring home with us. And I think it's probably why, again, because I do see, I mean, I don't see every post, but when it does come through my social media feed and there's some image that looks interesting, and then I begin to read and I do see, like you said, you're peeling back the layers of exposing that particular place and its interest or its culture or its food or its history, you know, whatever it is. And I can see that you're writing that from almost like from the position of the love for where you just were versus like, oh, here I am on vacation again somewhere.
I always try to find something in there that I love. And you're right. I look for the positive because that's just kind of my nature. Like, what's good about this place? What's interesting? What do I get out of it? What did I learn? And I come back a different person because my reference range of experiences grows. And I think I can bring that to my patients, but I also think I bring it to my art and the way I do plastic surgery. And I think it makes me a better doctor. So I'm a strong fan of that. When I get out, I come back a better doctor. Now, I could make a lot more money if I stayed home. And it's always been a struggle with me internally because it's something that you have to sacrifice. Do I want to stay home and do more facelifts and make more money? Or do I want to travel the world, have a richer life that I think makes me a better doctor in the end? And that's my choice. And that's not everyone's choice. Some people prefer to, you know, they're more comfortable. They're domesticators. They want to operate all day long and go home and, you know, sit in their backyard with a glass of wine or lemonade with their family. And that's beautiful too. We all have our own way of what we find attractive and fun and enjoyable.
Yeah. And I think we all have our own, you know, like, you know, to me, your life well lived so far. And that to me is how I would like my life to be. But for other people, yeah, they don't need to be doing all those things. And that's okay. That's okay.
We don't, I come from a family of a lot of people who didn't get the opportunity that they wanted. And I saw that. And I didn't want to be the person who was, you know, at the end of my life saying, oh, I wish I did this. I'm never going to say that. I'll pick up and go tomorrow. And it's something that excites me or I find it interesting. It's on my list. I'm out there soon.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So moving forward, we've been through publishing and marketing and social media and connectivity.
So it's still, practice is a big part of my existence. And I love operating and I love seeing patients. And it's interesting because some people are like, you still see patients or operate? I'm like, yeah, of course I do. But I don't document it as much as I do my travels. And I think some of that's because I'm so busy in the office. I'm so focused on what I'm doing. And it's not something I focus on showing that every day. But I have a fellowship program. I'm training constantly and teaching in the office and doing a lot of creative approaches in plastic surgery. And perhaps I should spend more time talking about that, but I don't. But that's still a big part of what I do. Teaching is also a big part of what I do. And I love teaching. And I'll spend half my time probably teaching. And research is another big component that I sprinkle into everything I do. So that keeps me very interested as well. But as many people know, I'm engaged to Sabrina Fabi, who's number 5 in the world, good plug for her, by Newsweek as a dermatologist. And she's highly respected and highly credentialed and is the 8th most published dermatologist in the country as per derm surgery. So incredibly motivated, more type A than me. And she's pregnant. So we have a baby coming in the next month. So talk about a new adventure. I got 3 older kids now from a previous marriage who are in their 20s. And now I have a new baby coming. So I'm entering a new class. And I just saw a picture of Robert De Niro and Al Pacino who are in their 70s and 80s. And they're having kids. So I'm like, hey, I'm not there. I'm not that old. But, you know, maybe it's good company.
Well, congratulations. That's amazing. And, you know, I think it's just how you now execute the rest of your life and combine your families. I'm sure your older children are equally as excited about the new baby coming into the family.
Well, it's definitely an exciting new venture. It's different. I won't be traveling as much. I can tell you that. So my writings won't be as much about travel, but I have some creative ideas. I don't think you need to go far to explore. You can explore in your own hometown.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I wonder, you know, because I myself too is like, you know, I feel like here, especially since the pandemic, I feel like even in Southern California, I'm seeing it with fresh eyes. I just think maybe because we're all back out again, you know, and we're not in isolation. And I just am seeing the beauty of where I am. And the opportunity of where I am, I don't necessarily need to be going out seeking. So I think you're right. And you're just going to be on such a new, amazing journey and experiencing a new life from a completely different perspective than you did the first time around.
And I have 3 girls and this is going to be a boy. So that's new. And I'm dad now, you know, I'm at the other end of my career as far as like, I'm at the early stages trying to get people in the door, just trying to build it. So I have more time. I can afford more help than I did the first time around. So all those things I think is going to make this a completely different experience.
Yes. And when will the baby be gracing us with its presence?
Well, August 18th is the day, so that's the plan date. So we'll see. That's coming up pretty soon.
Soon, that's coming up soon. Wow. Well, Steve, is there anything we haven't touched on that you feel you really want our audience to know about you or learn from you? Or
no, I'm out there. So if anyone, I'm always open to helping people out and teaching. And people call me for advice all the time, and I'm happy to take those calls. And I share openly. I'm really open about the things that I've done well, but the things where I failed also, which I think is equally, if not more important to share.
Yeah. If there was anything you could look back on as being either a favorite moment or a pivotal moment or just one last thing to share with our audience, what would that be?
I don't know if I could say there's one pivotal moment. I probably have to think a little bit deeper about that. I would say that it's going to be that you can't be afraid of hard work, and you got to embrace failure. Failure is good. If you accept failure, you will be more successful. You just have to be knowing, not repeat it, but not be afraid of it. You know, when I was coming through as a general surgeon, we would do appendectomies 25% of the time. We knew we weren't going to get a hot appendix. We knew we were going to fail 25% of the time, but that was so you can get all the, you can make sure you capture all the ones that are hot or are infected. I think that same philosophy kind of stuck with me. It's like, you know what? You know, you got to fail some to get to the good parts. Now, I'm not saying fail with like hurt patients or, you know, you got to be smart. You can't take unnecessary risk, but you got to push yourself out there a little bit and you got to take some risk. My youngest daughter now is trying to, or my oldest daughter wants to move to London, and she's deathly afraid to move, but it's been her dream. I'm like, go. But then I don't have a job. Just go. I don't have a job. What am I going to do? I'm like, just go. Go and see what happens. If you have to work, you know, as a sales clerk for a while, work as a sales clerk. You'll figure it out. So I'm a big fan of that.
I think as well is trusting that the life will be good and your future is, it's going to be okay.
I would say don't, you know, what we fear is really the unknown. Yes. We feel like what's going to happen. But what's funny is once the unknown becomes known, you don't fear it anymore. Mm-hmm. Once it becomes known, then you just deal with it. So what happens if I break up with that person? What happens if I lose my job? What happens if I get this horrible disease? Once you get it, you take care of it and you deal with it and you don't fear it anymore. It's really crazy, but it always happens. So don't fear the unknown.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for being on the Aesthetic Insider Show. I mean, it's been a great interview. I've loved having you with us today, and just thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, and please feel free to reach out anytime.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for those of you still watching, please remember to tune in, watch on Wednesdays for another exciting episode of the Aesthetic Insider Show. Thank you.